Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring April Vokey, and she'll be answering your most important questions on steelhead of the Dean River. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask April a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with April Vokey about steelhead of the Dean River. Mystic Fly Rod's new switch series is turning heads and taking it easy on your wallet, a refreshing trend in today's premium fly rod market. To learn why the switch was selected as America's number one switch rod in Fly Fish America's 2012 gear guide, visit mysticoutdoors.com or cruise over to your local fly shop to unleash its power. We dare you to compare the switch or any Mystic fly rod to your current favorite. Once you do, we think you'll agree Mystic is the new brand of choice in premium fly rods. Make the switch to Mystic at www.mysticoutdoors.com. That's www.mysticoutdoors.com. Well, before we introduce April, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we're going to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under April's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a one-year subscription to Hook Now, an offline e-zine published by Dave Hughes, Rick Hafley, and Skip Morris. And to find out more about that e-zine publication, go to www.hookednow.com. Now, to win the Hooked Now subscription, here's how you can win it. You must be the first person to answer the question at the end of the show. The question is going to be about something that April and I talk about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location using that text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, and maybe you'll win that subscription. Tonight, our guest is April Vokey. April lives in British Columbia, is an avid angler and steelhead, salmon, and trout guide. She was born with an unexplainable passion for fishing. As a young girl, she coaxed her father into going fishing, and by the age of 16, when she was old enough to drive, she was devoting all of her free time to her local rivers. She is passionate about spey casting the wild steelhead, the environment, and tying salmon and steelhead flies. She has made it her mission to encourage and introduce aspiring anglers to the sport in hopes that it will bring them as much pleasure as it has brought her. She takes pride in being an eternal student of fly fishing and an active conservationist. In 2007, she founded British Columbia-based guiding operation Fly Gal Ventures, where she presently guides and instructs anglers on some of British Columbia's best steelhead destinations. Fly Gal's trips and events can be found at www.flygal.ca. April is a Federation of Fly Fishers certified casting instructor and fly fishing columnist. She is the Canadian field editor for Chasing Silver magazine and the steelhead columnist for Fly Fusion magazine. Her works and photos can also be found in Fly Fisherman magazine, Salmon Trout Steelheader, Field and Stream, Canadian Fly Fisher, Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, and several other international publications. April sits on the board of directors for the Steelhead Society of British Columbia and the British Columbia Federation of Fly Fishers. She is the founder and director of the popular fundraiser Flies for Fins. And in 2011, she proudly joined the Patagonia Ambassador team, where she continues to assist in the design and direction of an upcoming women's line of fishing apparel. April, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thanks, Roger.
You're there.
I am. Great. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you good now. So we've got lots of questions. little bit of controversy to talk about tonight.
It always is.
It always is, yeah. So let's dive in. Our listeners have contributed substantially as normal, as they always do, and sent in a bunch of questions. And so we're going to talk about a few things tonight. We'll talk about the Dean River, a bit about some of the other rivers up there in British Columbia that you work with, and a bit about the conservation and use aspects and the specifics about the Dean itself and what a great fishery it is and how to fish it and how to get the most out of it. So lots to talk about. So we do have an international audience, April, so I like to start out any kind of geographic, whenever we're talking about a fishery, talk about the geographic aspects of it. So where is the Dean River in the world?
Well, it's off the coast in British Columbia. More specifically, it's off the coast of Bella Coola. So right off the ocean, the Dean pours in, and that's where we are.
And how big a river is the Dean, mile-wise or kilometers?
You know, I actually don't know the answer to that. That's a great question. I am specifically on the lower stretch of the Dean. So there's two different areas on the Dean. The canyon basically is the divider. So So our lodge is on the lower stretch. We only have, realistically, it's around 4.5 to 5 kilometers of fishable water until we get to the canyon. I've spent a little bit of time upriver on my days off, but I haven't explored it as much as the other lodges have up there.
Is that primarily the steelhead fishery is below the canyon?
No, it's definitely very productive fishery above the canyon. They have great numbers and wonderful dry fly fishing up there. The river isn't quite as wide, and it's a lot more traditional angling methods. With us, we have wider water, which, of course, we'll go into more later. And just there's lots of water. The fish push through. We did a study. The biologist did a study, and it shows that the fish in our stretch don't stay there for longer than 24 hours. So they come in, and then they've got to make that incredible canyon, which is why they're so strong, and then they get upstream for all the anglers up there.
Okay. Now, what other steelhead rivers are in the area, and how does the Dean rank amongst them as a fishery?
Well, it's a tricky question. There's a few rivers up there. I will not really go into them. I don't really know that much about them. In fact, I don't even know if they all have steelhead. But I'd say the most prominent fishery in that region would be the Kimsquit, and it's renowned mostly for its salmon run and definitely for its grizzly bear viewing.
Okay. Well, we've got a comment from Pete Sovereau, I think it is, and kind of controversial, but I'll go ahead and read it. And as we discussed before the show, you would like to discuss his comments here and talk about things. And this is something that we're all concerned about, I think, all over the world. And so it'll be interesting to hear your take on it. But let me read what Pete said and then get your response to what he said. And this is in response to the show tonight about the Dean River. Are you crazy? This is like talking about the intimate details of your love life. You might note that Haig Brown never once wrote about the Thompson River, even though he regularly fished it for a month or so every year. I have fished the Dean for almost 30 years and have never published a story about it. The Dean hardly needs more anglers or attention. I cannot imagine that your Dean River employer thinks it's a good idea to promote the Dean, attracting more anglers to compete with your clients. I hope you will mention that the Dean has not made its steelhead or Chinook escapement goals in decades. So what's your response to Pete?
First response is, hi, Pete. I'd love to get up to Russia. I know that Pete has an operation that he manages up there in the Kamchatka area. So I know that he understands to some degree that there is a certain amount of marketing that comes into play when you need to have a fishery get some attention to it, whether it be for conservation purposes or otherwise. But more importantly, I'm just going to break down the question. And are you crazy? No. It is, though, like talking about the intimate details of your love life. I definitely agree with Pete there, and I'm going to address that more. Not my love life, of course, but the that it is an intimate conversation here. Hank Brown did not write about the Compton, largely in part because he didn't need to. And more so, you know, Hank Brown spent a lot more time writing about the streams off the Vancouver Island. And anyone that's from that region knows that a lot of the streams that are mentioned in Hank Brown's book are also very quiet streams that shouldn't maybe have the attention drawn to them. Furthermore, I would like to note that other anglers and friends that I would call much like Bart Lindgren and Trey Combs, they have actually devoted entire books and chapters on the Dean. So to have a finger pointed at me is a little bit ridiculous, but that's not to say that if it's wrong, that me doing it makes it any better. So I would like to explain why we are going to talk about it tonight. If people don't know about rivers, then nobody is going to help them. So while it may appear selfish for me as a guide to come on here and speak about a river, it's more selfish for an angler to keep their mouth shut about it, and I'll explain to you why. There's a river at home, out by Chilliwack. It's a very small little river, and nobody fishes it. And it's very quiet, and for years I've been fishing it, and I've never run into anybody out there. And recently I got a slap in the face saying that there was a power plant project that was going to be put on this river. And I chose to not say anything about it and to see if I could try to gather maybe some friends to fight the battle. And, of course, we didn't have the numbers, and so there is now a power plant going on that river. Even more important, say around 10, 11 years ago, when I was on the Thompson, I wanted to mention the Thompson. And everybody jumped down my throat. You know, I stayed at the hilltop, and I had a bunch of buddies up there, and they'd say, "Are you crazy?" Just like this. Just like Pete's comment, "Are you crazy? We don't talk about the Thompson. It's never to be mentioned." And so I didn't say anything, and I was very, very quiet about the Thompson. And then it started to die, and all of the conservation issues at hand were out of control. And there was only one way to fix it, and it was to get the public on our side. So we had to start screaming to people that we needed their help. But unfortunately, by the time that we started screaming, we waited too late, and now we're playing the cleanup game. You know, and I devote all my time into Flies for Fins lately, which, of course, we'll talk about later, to try to raise money for these projects for the Thompson. But I'm constantly kicking myself that it took me so long in my immaturity and in my youth. I kept my mouth shut about what we needed to do. And so when I started on the Dean, we were kind of quiet about it. Unfortunately, what Pete doesn't know is that my employer is actually myself, and I think it's a great idea, but the lodge that brings me in, that I'm affiliated with, brought me in to do this exact job. They brought me in to help promote so that they could fill the lodge. From my end, especially because we're doing all right on bookings, I'm promoting it because I want people to know that we need their help now, because I'm not going to wait like we did on the Thompson until it's too late. So long story short, the Dean last year had some very serious issues that impacted the fishery with commercial netting. Recently, I finished Bob Hooten's book on skeena steelhead that goes into a large, I mean, the entire book is based around commercial netting. It has me so riled up that, I mean, we've got to start doing something now. I don't know how much time, Roger, you want to spend on focusing on the whole weed line issue that we had on the Dean this year, or any of the real, you know, nitty-gritty biology or logistical parts of what we're facing there. But if we don't start getting people rounded up for this now, we're not going to stand a chance on the Dean either. We've watched the skeena go through hell with the Enbridge line and with the Sacred Headwaters, and we've watched the government get away with all that they're doing right now, which is, of course, like a 10-hour conversation that we just won't have time for tonight. But if we don't start rounding up people today, you know, me using this as my opportunity to speak to people to know that the Dean's a special place, and when I call back to you and I say I need your help, you know, 6 months or a year from now, I need you guys to know where I'm coming from so that you can say, okay, you got us. I mean, we're here right now. That's really long drawn. I do apologize for ranting. And Pete, if I were going to say one thing, it would be look at the Kokish. You know, I don't know if you know that I sit on the board of directors for the Steelhead Society. I do know the board that you sit on, and I respect very much what you do, but look at the Kokish. We weren't supposed to speak of the Kokish, and look what happened to it. We finally started to scream about the Kokish, and now we're trying desperately to turn some heads. So, come on. You know, I don't really know what else to say other than don't be selfish, and I'm not here to to be a pimp to the fishery. I'm here to try to make things right. And the more that we argue with each other, the more things aren't going to get done. So we may as well just hold hands and do this the right way.
Yeah, and I agree with you totally, April. I think, well, I've been on the planet a lot longer than you have, and I've seen places that I used to go when I was 18, 19 years old that I have to get a permit now to go and put my tent on because of the number of people going to the area. And that's just kind of a fact we have to deal with around the world. And even Kamchatka will someday be a place that will be so popular that we won't want to tell people about it. So that just brings up the question of, yes, you know, how do we preserve these areas so that our children and grandchildren can enjoy them like we did? And I think a lot of that falls on people like you, guides and outfitters, that are right there standing in the water every day. And who better to lead the charge?
Well, and we'll talk about that, too, you know, because there's a few questions that were asked that I do want to speak about guide activism. But something that not a lot of people know is that the Dean already is very unique in that it's controlled. I'll be honest with you. So, Roger, I got your list today of questions, and I didn't get them until later today, so my heart started going a little crazy when I realized that the entire interview was based around the Dean River. So I made some calls to some other guides in the area that work for other lodges that have been around for a long time, and I even called Paul Hooten, who was the regional biologist for the Skeena section, and got a lot of answers to a lot of my questions just to confirm that me doing this interview was indeed the right thing and not something horribly devastating. And the answer that I need to really project to people is that it's not like just anybody can come in and fish the Dean. And I know that people ask this throughout the interview, so we will get to these questions later, but it's been a lottery draw. And for as long as many of us can remember, I don't know if ever actually, the lottery draw has never been met. I mean, there's always been enough space. So even if we had, let's say that I'm so incredibly popular that the entire world is listening to this interview right now, and every single one of the people has enough money to go in and buy a ticket to come to the Dean. Well, the government, I mean, even though they have their downfalls, the operations around here have made it so that the government has a limit. So there's only so many people that are accepted to come in. Furthermore, as an outfitter, we're only allowed to have our guests, and the law is that non-residents of BC, meaning if you're even from Alberta, you're only allowed to come in for 8 days. It doesn't matter how much money you have or who you are. You can only come in for 8 days at a time. Per year. And there's a lottery draw. So it's controlled. And I think we all know that the pressure on the river isn't as bad as some people might think it is. So, yeah.
So even if, like you say, everybody wanted to go there all next week, it's impossible. And so it's controlled. I know, you know, that's happening down here in different ways, not so much with fishing as far as lottery, but running rivers. You know, for instance, the Grand Canyon and Dinosaur National Monument and places like that. You have to go, you know, there are lotteries or programs that you have to wait in line to get in there. And the reason is so that isn't bumper to bumper or shoulder to shoulder. And it is nice when you do go down there. It frustrates many of us because sometimes you go for years without getting a chance, but what else are you going to do, you know? And living out west, you know, I've seen pictures of the shoulder-to-shoulder fishing that sometimes happens on the East Coast on opening day, and I just cringe thinking about it, you know, that I would have to fish like that. So I think, you know, it sounds like it is being managed and that you aren't being flooded with people and you're not all lining the banks. And so, you know, what are we worried about? And as long as those controls are still in place, you know, then and it doesn't get out of hand, then it's got a good fishery.
Knock on wood that we can keep it in place. You know, over the past couple of years, we've really noticed the marketing aspect of the Dean. It's getting out of control. I mean, every single magazine has an article in it, and there's cover shots, and there's some people that go around and they do presentations on the Dean, and the Internet has the Dean everywhere, and it really isn't out of control. This isn't one of those rivers that you just decide you're going to go fish one day.
It's
managed.
Well, we'll move on and start talking about the fishery here. And but there did a question did come in on the Internet here from Dean Burris in Austin.
Hi, Dean.
He wants to know, what is the most impactful thing that people living outside of BC can do to help protect the Dean River and or other rivers?
Well, that's a great question. Let's focus more on other rivers, because it's the other rivers that need your help more so than the Dean right now. And the answer to that is we need to put the pressure on the government. You know, I don't know. I do know Dean follows a little bit of what goes on online with regards to the Skeena fishery and the battle I've been fighting with the Sacred Headwaters. Can we talk about that real quick, Roger?
Yeah, let me, before you jump into that, let me take a quick break, and then we'll come right back and we can talk about that, okay?
Great.
Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com to view the fishing products and guide services they offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about the Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with April Vokey about steelhead of the Dean River. If you'd like to ask April a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, April. And just so you know, we're going to run your PSA for Sacred Waters at the end of the show. So,
thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, so not to duplicate too much of that, but give us a brief rundown on that, and then we'll jump into the fishing on the Dean.
Sure. Long story short, recently there was this big battle that we've had. We've been fighting the shell. You know, shell is coming in, and they want to spin a bunch of wells, and they want to do a bunch of fracking in the Sacred Headwaters. So I won't get too much into that, but I'll let you know that I had written a feature story for Fly Fusion magazine, and the guys at Fly Fusion were great. A lot of magazines won't publish such a controversial piece. What the public doesn't know is that we went through a meltdown with this. We had to hire a lawyer. The lawyer fees were crazy. We had to make sure we weren't going to get sued. Sorry, there's something going around here. We had to bring – what's that? Oh, it's pollen.
Pollen. Yeah, there's pollen all over the country.
And so what happened was it was a really big deal. You know, we had to make sure I wasn't going to get sued, that the magazine wasn't going to get sued, and we decided we were going to bite the bullet and we were going to go through with it anyway. So I called them all the favors, and they published it. And the response was unbelievable. Letters, I mean, I had made it clear that I would help people write their letters. People flocked, letters poured in. We made such an impact in the government office that the Skeena Watershed Coalition has said that the government said they haven't. I mean, they ended up changing over the person that manages their communication, and there was a whole bunch of stuff that ended up going on in the office. But the point is, without boring anybody, the point is that all of the letters made a huge, huge difference. Does that mean that it's going to change anything? We'll see. We have less than 1 year to find out what's going to happen. But it made a huge difference when the public got on board and started screaming and they started yelling. People that do this, I mean, the government listens to some degree, we hope.
Yeah, yeah.
That answers Dean's question. We just need to make sure that we don't just keep quiet about it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you've got some websites, and we'll drop the website name for the Skeena and so forth later on. So
yeah.
And real quick, just so that people do know about your business, and you do run a guide service up there, tell us a little bit about your business and also tell us what your website is, how people can get a hold of you if they'd like to learn more about what you're doing, your causes, as well as your guide service.
Sure, yeah. I own a company called Fly Gal Ventures, and I started the company when I was 23, so it's been a while. And I wanted to bring into the industry something different. I wanted to bring in something that was experience-based and something that was a little more unique than just get them in and get them out. So we really focus on our guests when they come in and make sure that their day is not only enjoyable, but has, you know, a certain amount of entertainment. We like that. Like any good guide, most of our guides are pretty good at entertaining. And we try to treat our guests like they're not just a number. So that's really all that we do. You know, we do a lot of schools. I do a lot of teaching. That's where most of my passion is teaching people how to cast and how to tie flies. And we have we're really unique in that we get a great round of people. We've got a lot of women. I think this year our women percent for guests was, I think it came in at like 45% is what I was looking at. And most of our schools have around 90% ladies that take the casting classes. So it's very cool in that we get a lot of the guys, we get a lot of the girls. We offer parent youth classes, so we teach a lot of the kids how to cast, and we teach the parents how to teach them as well. So we're just really fortunate in that our team has people that can relate to all genders, all ages.
Now, do you, as far as your guiding goes, do you primarily guide on the Dean, or are there other rivers you guide on?
My schedule is the same every year. So February, March, April, I guide in the Lower Mainland on some of the Winter Run steelhead tributaries to the Fraser. And then I head up to the Dean the end of June, all of July and all of August. And then from there, I go straight to Terrace, where I stay for several months. And I haven't started guiding up there yet. We've got other guides that work for us up there. I try to fish with my guests and just take a little bit of downtime after the guiding season on the Dean.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the year, every year.
Okay, and what's your website address?
It is www.flygal.ca.
www.flygal.ca. Great.
You got it.
Okay, let's talk about the Dean. Since it is on a, you had mentioned a lottery basis, is that a lottery basis for the guides or for individuals? In other words, do I have to submit to the lottery, or does the guide submit to the lottery?
You, as an individual angler, need to apply.
Okay. And then
so you, don't, so you would go online.
And so I would have to first participate in the lottery. If I get picked, then I have my choice of how I want to fish the Dean, right? I mean, what lodge I want to go to, what guide, if I want to do it myself or whatever. Do I have it right?
Yeah, right now it's not really a matter of getting picked, though. So you basically just go on and buy your license. When you come through the lodge, you just let them know that who your guide is and then enter that into your
form. Okay, so it's not, so the lottery isn't really, I mean, like the river systems around here where we have to go to the lottery, there are, you know, maybe 10 times as many people as there are permits. So that sounds like it's not the case.
It's not the case right now.
Okay.
But after this interview, it might be. No, I'm just kidding.
That won't make Pete happy. Okay. So how does one get to the Dean, assuming that I was successful in the lottery and I want to go fishing? Where do I,
you have
how
to
do I get
fly
there?
It.
Okay.
You have to fly into the Dean. This is a tough one because a lot of people have questions on the upper Dean, and I don't fish there very often, upriver. Mm-hmm. So I can't really answer any of the questions on the upper Dean. But on the lower Dean, you have to fly in, and typically we obviously arrange that for our guests, but a little landing strip for you to land in.
But where do you fly from? Seattle?
Well, you can fly either from South Florida. You go from Seattle into Vancouver, and then Vancouver into Anaheim Lake or Bella Coola.
Okay.
Depending on who your pilot is.
Okay. Now, those locations are by the river, or you have to realize some of us have never been there.
Okay, that's okay. They're about an hour flight out of there.
Okay, so from those locations, then you send somebody to get them and bring them down to the Dean.
Yeah, so what happens is they, our guests, for us, our guests come into Vancouver, and then we either fly them into Bella Coola or in Anaheim Lake, depending on the time of year, flight costs, et cetera, et cetera. And then we fly them from either of those locations directly onto the Dean.
Okay. Okay. And is it, do you have to land on the river itself, or?
Well, you won't land on the river. Our lodge is located directly on the ocean, so you can, we have a float plane that lands right on the ocean.
Oh, I see. Okay. Great. And how many guide services would you say service the Dean?
There's only four, and that's grandfathered in, so there will never be more. There's two guide services above the falls. They're both incredible. And then there's two guide services below the falls, also, in my opinion, both incredible. So there's myself, who works out of the lodge that's owned by the Blackwells. And then there's Dunedin, or BC West. And it's cool because we both offer very different experiences. So it makes choosing a lodge very simple because they're just so different.
Mm-hmm. Now, does one have to go and stay at a lodge and use a guide, or can you, or could someone go up there and, you know, do a do-it-yourself trip?
Well, in the lower stretch, you need to have a jet boat. So it's a tricky one, and there's just not a whole lot of water there. So 4.5-5 kilometers of water, and the guides are usually pretty on top of it. So do-it-yourself is tough.
Okay.
I know, that's not the answer everyone wants, I'm sorry.
Well, some of these places like that, it just it doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, it's more of a production to get in there to do it yourself than it is to hire somebody and do it.
If you crunch the numbers, I mean, if you're a number cruncher and you crunch a do-it-yourself versus a lodge, you'll typically end up with an extra 1,000 or extra 1,500 or 2,000. You're going to have everything else taken care of. There's a lot that goes into it, you know. There's food and then transportation and then your flights. And then, of course, it's very dangerous up there. So we suggest that you do know the river. And then there's bears, and there's just a lot to factor into that sort of trip. This is not the sort of trip that you're going to wake up tomorrow and decide you're going to do.
Yeah, yeah, jump in the car and take off. Yeah, it's just, you can't
do that. Yeah, no, not going to happen.
John in Pleasanton, California, wrote in, and he says, I've heard for years that the Dean River is a great steelhead fishery, but I've also heard that it's very expensive to fish there, and some areas of the river are nearly impossible to access with the waiting list for guests. What is the truth? Is it affordable?
Well, that's a matter of what you believe is affordable. It is very expensive, in my opinion. It's one of our more expensive trips. You know, we run at $5,200 Canadian, but then it's also another $950 Canadian to fly out of Vancouver and back. So then, you know, you're basically looking at $6,200 plus tax, plus another $400-some-odd in licenses for the lodge. That is definitely an expensive trip. Do it yourself. I can't give you a number because I don't know anything about it.
Sure, no, don't bother.
I would say that definitely upriver. There's some lodges that I think they've got like a 95% booked rate, and most of the lodges are pretty close to being booked over the past couple of years. 10 years or 5, 6, 4, even three years ago, you would have had no problem getting in. But with fishing getting better, it's getting a little trickier to get in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a tough one. I recently went on a trip to Seychelles, and Seychelles, I think it's $7,500. And I can't afford that. That's crazy. So I had to really sit down and figure out how I would pay for this. And it's just a matter of putting monthly payments away. Again, it's one of those things that, I mean, you wait for your whole life to go do it, and then when you do it, you just cost off the list.
Yeah, exactly. Rod in Portland, Oregon wants to know, what's one thing to do to prepare for a fishing trip on the Dean other than a guide? What stands out in your mind as one thing that people didn't know or should know about the river, the watershed? And he also writes, thanks for supporting the Flies for Fins.
Thank you, Rod. Thank you for supporting Flies for Fins.
Yeah.
I don't do anything except get everything shipped out. Okay, other than a guide, make sure you've got good flies. It's amazing how many people show up with these horrible flies that just have no motion as they swing through the current. And I have a swim tank, and when I do my tying classes, I demonstrate to people what their fly looks like as it swims through the current in the tank. And they show up with there's this horrible little fly that's made out of stacked deer and Amherst, and it looks just awful in the water. So I would say definitely make sure you've got good flies. Make sure that you have a second pair of waders for the lower stretch of the river to prepare for it. Make sure you can cast a little bit further or a little more efficiently than you usually would.
What does that mean? What distance acceptable?
It's not even, on the lower stretch you do want to have some distance. Some of the best anglers that I've seen out there can cast the furthest. And I'm not a huge advocate on being the best caster, because I'm not the best caster. And I certainly don't think you need to cast over the fish to get fish. But oftentimes, the further you can cast, the longer your fly is in the water. And because of the lower stretch, the runs are so wide, it definitely makes a difference for every second that your fly is in the water. So it's just a real shame when you have an angler that's spent $6,000 to come, and they're very excited, but it takes them 2 days to get into the casting groove. So I would just say, just be ready. You know, you save up for this for your whole life on your bucket list. Make sure that you're ready for it as an angler in general.
Well, let's talk about that more in a minute when we talk about equipment and rods and so forth, because I think that's a good thing to talk about in more depth. Let me take another quick break here, and then we'll come back and let's talk about fish, the other kinds of fish in the river, and then equipment and flies. So be right back. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 25 years, and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on guide, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging on to their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. Okay, just a little bit about the fish there. What are the size of the steelhead in the Dean? Are they substantial compared to, for instance, Great Lakes steelhead? What's an average steelhead that you would catch there?
An average fish is anywhere between 8 to 12 pounds. I can tell you it with full honesty that the best fish, in my opinion, is a 10-pound female. They are the hottest fish in the world, in my opinion. I mean, they just, oh my God, they're bullets.
And
but they get bigger. I mean, they get over 20 pounds.
Okay, okay. And here's a question from Jeff in Chilliwack, B.C. The steelheaders are known for their die-hard, fish-all-winner-for-one-or-two-fish approach. This is something we're proud of and enjoy doing. Why would one want to fish the Dean where catching five fish a day is possible and easy? Doesn't it take the challenge out of steelheading? Is what he's saying true about the Dean?
Hi, Jeff. That's Paul, and I'm telling you. Steelheaders are known for the diehard fish all winter for one or two fish approach, but I love them for that, and it makes us into better anglers. And if the question was, would catching 55 fish a day, you know, if it was phrased like that, I'd say definitely, you know, it does take the challenge out. But to catch five fish a day on the Dean is an incredible day, you know. We typically range anywhere between one to, I've seen up to 10 fish caught. So, you know, you got, say, one to 10 fish. But is it easy? No. The guys that are catching 10 fish are working their butts off for them. But five fish a day as a steelheader who has put in their time and knows what they're doing, yeah, they deserve it. It doesn't take the challenge out. It just makes it more rewarding.
Yeah, yeah. And so you've kind of addressed my next question, what would be the expectation? So you could say, you know, one to five fish would be what you would tell people they could expect to catch if they work hard, right?
Yeah, no, that's catch. Landed's a totally different story.
Oh, okay. Let's.
Terrible. So I've got a lot of winter steelhead, and Jeff's in Chilliwack, which is where I live, and I know how those fish fight, and they're great. They're fantastic fish. But I'm telling you, on my grandpa's grave, these Dean River fish are the most incredibly hard-pulling, energetic fish I've ever hooked into in my life. It's not even comparable to any other fishery in the world. So it's not easy. It's not.
Wow. Wow. Okay. What are the different seasons? This is from Doug Clean in Calgary. And he's asking, what are the different fishing seasons on the Dean? And other than steelhead, what salmon would you find in the different seasons?
Well, I could answer that, but I'm not going to, just in that we're only open for June, July, and August, and that's legally. I mean, legally we're only open for that summer run, so.
Oh, okay.
Although there may be other runs, they're not legally open, so we kind of don't talk about them.
Okay. But that's, I mean, by government law, that is the season, one season?
Yeah, but the Chinook come in June. And the Chinook are like nothing I've ever seen before. I mean, they're fresh from the ocean. They're incredibly bitey. And the August run of coho and early September run of coho that we do stay open for are just as incredible. I mean, you won't know if you've got a steelhead or a coho on until you've got it in.
Okay, interesting. So the next question was from Ed in Templeton, California. He wanted to know, he says he's tied up the majority of the fall and winter months. The Dean is my dream British Columbia trip. Would any of the spring months be a possibility? So you're saying no, right?
Just have to wait for June. But what happens is we have what's called freshet. So freshet is when all the snow melts, all the snowpad melts, and the rivers rise. And it blows the rivers out. So for June, typically the first 2 or 3 weeks even of June are non-fishable. And that's just because the rivers are too high. So it opens, you know, it's you got to wait till the end of June, really.
Okay. Let's talk about equipment a little bit. Doug McLean, again, in Calgary, asks, are spey rods the rods of choice for the Dean? And if so, what size and types of lines are typically used?
For the lower stretch of the Dean, yes. Spey rods are definitely the rod of choice, just in that we can cast further with them, and we don't need to worry about trees behind us, because we're only creating a D-loop rather than casting a full-blown false cast that's extending, you know, X amount of feet behind us. So for winter steelhead, spey rods are preferred because they can turn over heavy sink tips and flies. But on the Dean, we don't need to have heavy sink tips and heavily weighted flies. So we just really like to be able to not have to hit trees behind us and be able to cast further. I fish in 8 weights. I would say you could get away with, no, I don't even want to say you could get away with a 7. You're going to want an 8. And if there's chinook in the river, you're going to want to have a 9. And most of our clients show up with skagit lines just because they are the easiest line to cast. Yeah, but you can get away with a long belly line as well. But skagit lines are what we suggest for people to show up with.
Okay. And describe for those that have never used a skagit line, what is a skagit line?
A skagit line is a glorified shooting head. So it's a condensed fly line. It's basically, say, like I work. So Rio, for example, they've got a 26-foot skagit line head. And say that you need to have enough grain weight to load your rod, and it's 550 grains. So you have 550 grains condensed grain weight in 26 feet of line. And then it's attached to what's called slick shooter or a running line, which is basically also a glorified monofilament that is attached so that when you shoot the head out, it is able to fly through the air with ease.
Okay. Now, so you said you don't have any use for sink tips and weighted lines.
No, you do. I fish a sink tip.
Oh.
I fish a sink tip a lot, actually, until we get into fishing dry lines. But you don't need to have, now, for steelhead I'm talking. For chinook, you need to have huge sink tips, get down really deep, really fast. But with steelhead, you get away with a type 6 tip, for example, or something that's moderately light. You don't need to come in all the time with 15 feet of lead core or anything for steelhead.
Jeff in Chilliwack asks another question. Why aren't mid to long belly lines used more when you're fishing for active summer fish? They are much more fun to cast.
They're probably much more fun to cast for Jeff. They're not much more fun to cast for people who have never done it before.
And the skagit is easier?
Well, what happens is people automatically assume that because, yes, it's much easier, but people assume that because it's summer run fish and it's July and August that the river is low and clear, which it is at times. But we, for example, last year, I think we had 2 days of sun, and we had a ton of rain, and the water was up and colored. And we have no choice but to fish sink tips to get them down in front of the fish. So we absolutely do fish long belly lines and dry lines, but it just depends on the water conditions. As all steelheaders know, it's never that cut and dry. If it was that cut and dry, everybody would be a great steelheader. But you need to work with what you've got. Chocolate milk, you got to get it down.
Okay. Now, you did say a few minutes ago that at times during chinook season that, you don't know whether you're going to get a chinook or a steelhead. And Duke in New York asked about different techniques or gear setups for different species, like steelhead or salmon. Mm. So are you fishing for one or the other? Do you just get lucky and, you know, get a Chinook or a steelhead? Because it sounds like you're not sight fishing to them. Is that the case?
When the Chinook are in the system, there is no sight fishing because the river is so high and colored up that you simply can't see. You know, if you have 2 feet of visibility, that's actually pretty good conditions for Chinook. So sometimes you do get lucky, but different species hold in different waters. So Chinook, being as large as they are, often need to have the oxygen going through their body. So they'll fish, they'll sit in a lot of faster water or some sort of a riffle. The steelhead typically will sit in a little bit slower water. So you can determine what sort of species you're targeting by the water that you're fishing. But oftentimes it's a lot of luck of the draw.
But the same rigging, the same flies would work for either? Or would you rig up?
Well, the same flies, as far as rigging up, you're going to want to be prepared for that Chinook. So even though you could get away with fishing, say, a 7-weight rod for early steelhead, because typically earlier in the year we get the tackier run of fish coming in, and we also get, which is a smaller strain of fish that come through. We get a lot of females that are a little smaller than the big bucks that come in later. So you could get away with a 7-weight for steelhead, but if you're going to get a 60-pound Chinook, it'd be nice to have a 9-weight just in case. And flies, the Chinook like to have, they typically, in my experience, bite darker flies, black flies, blue and chartreuse flies. And the steelhead are more prone to biting pink, orange, on the lower stretch anyway.
Okay. So really, you're fishing for one or the other. If you're trying to target one, you're going to target them with different flies. And if you do get one while fishing for the other, then it's just kind of chance.
You could be a confident angler fishing a black fly on your 9-weight all day and know that you have a good shot at getting a Chinook and or a steelhead. But you'd be less confident fishing a small pink fly on your 7-weight in knowing that there's Chinook in the system.
Yeah, okay. Good. Doug, again, up in Calgary, Alberta, what style of flies are successful for different fish? And he's talking about seasons, but we only got one season. So and there was a later question by Duke, what are your 5 favorite flies? So let's talk about your steelhead flies and what you like to work with.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is a very different question if I were a guide upriver above the canyon.
Okay.
Those fish are very, they're a lot chubbier, and they definitely are looking up at dry flies and taking a lot of the more traditional patterns.
Okay.
On the lower stretch, though, the traditional patterns are still very effective. I'm a big fan of Art Lindgren, and I use a lot of his style flies. I do like to fish general practitioners and the more classic flies, but I find that I have most confidence with just like an intruder style of prawn. Now, that's not to say that they're huge. You know, you don't need to fish these overly obnoxious 4-inch flies, but I like to have my flies that have, what I do with all my flies is I dub polar bear or arctic fox if you're in America, and then I'll take some marabou and do a couple wraps of marabou and then lay over a couple strands of rhea or ostrich. And a couple strands of flash, and those are my go-to flies. They don't need to be too obnoxious. It depends on the water levels and the clarity. But typically orange, pink style flies work best on the lower stretch of the beam. We advise that most people's flies have an extending hook, so that makes that little extra bit of leverage, and or they use tube flies, which I think is a question that I saw in here somewhere.
Yeah, Joe in Pennsylvania asked about tube flies.
Mm-hmm. They're great. I would say that the answer is something that has good motion and good movement as it breathes or pulsates while you're swinging it through, and something that you have confidence in.
Now, you said you did use stinger hooks, is that?
I do, yeah, I use stinger hooks. And part of that reason is when there's Chinook in the system, I like to be able to switch up to put a 2-aught on or a size 2, depending on the run, without having to retie an entirely different fly.
Okay. Okay, Duke in New York asks, do you think that steelheads respond to or key in on certain features of a swung fly? if so, what are those features, and how do you incorporate those features in your fly design? And I guess that's basically what you were just talking about, the movement.
Yeah, I really, and this is all, and we're talking all swinging flies here. Obviously, if we were talking dry flies, it's different. But, I can't begin to tell you how helpful that swim tank is that I have. It really lets me see what they look like as they swim through the current. And I personally have the most confidence when I have that little bit of dubbing, because it does maintain that breathing, pulsating look as it flows through the current. I think anything that looks too static just isn't going to have the same response, but who knows? I think the number one ingredient in any fly should just be confidence.
Mm-hmm. We had a question come in on the Internet here. Paul in Washington wanted to know about, which we didn't talk about, is the terminal tackle. And I think there was another one that had come in earlier. You want to talk about how you set up for that, since we kind of skipped over that?
Terminal tackle?
Yeah. Using cedar.
It's okay. No. Oh, okay. You're not talking about conventional gear.
No.
Okay.
Cedar and tippets.
We use Maxima, just monofilaments, anywhere 12 to 15 pounds. When you're fishing a sink tip, you don't want to have too long of a leader because you're trying to keep your fly down. So just several feet. And then with dry lines, I mean, just the 9-foot standard paper leader.
Okay. And what strength tippet?
You're going to want to have something that can.
Pardon me?
You're not going to want to underline yourself with these fish. So, because on the lower stretch, you don't need to worry about them being overly spooky because they're so aggressive. You're going to want to make sure you have somewhere between 10 to 15 pounds.
Okay. Grant in Surrey, BC, he says, I fish your Vader or Vetter?
The Vetter River, yes.
And never, how do you spell that?
The Vetter?
V-E-D-D-E-R?
V-E-D-D-E-R, yeah.
Oh, okay. So, and he says he never seems to have any luck with dry flies catching steelhead on it. Is that a dry fly, the Vetter?
Well, the reason why he hasn't had any luck with dry flies is because it's a winter steelhead fishery. And it's one of the harder winter steelhead fisheries because of the amount of pressure on the river. It's got a hatchery on it, so right away you have an abundant amount of people that show up to it. And these fish hunker down, and they just try to get through. So recommendations for dry flies and floating lines on that river is I don't have any for you. I just don't. I personally don't have any confidence fishing a dry fly on the Vetter. What you will end up getting later in the year are steelhead smolt. A lot of people call them rainbows, but they're smolt, so we try to advise people to not fish for those. I have had clients, though. I had a client last year who had never cast before, and I put her on a dry line just to get her comfortable, and she cast out this little black fly that I had on just for casting purposes, and she got a 15-pounder on her dry line with a little black fly. But yeah, it was incredible. It was beautiful to watch, but not a dry fly. I wish I could help you with that. And if you can figure that out, Grant, please let me know because, oh, my God, I'd kill to see it.
I didn't realize Vetter was a river rather than a fly. I thought he was talking about a fly when he said you are
Vetter.
Oh,
yeah, so the Chilliwack River and the Vetter River are they're the same river. They're just separated by a bridge.
Okay. Jeff in Chilliwack again. Do you weight your flies or let your sink tip do the work?
That's a wonderful question. This depends entirely on the time of year, the fishery, what the river is looking like, who's fished through before me. There's a whole lot that goes into that. But typically, if I were going to answer that quickly, it would be that I actually do not weight my flies, and I let my sink tip do most of the work. When I fish smaller coastal streams, or I'm fishing a lot of boulder or pocket water, then I'll fish a small weighted fly that can punch down in through behind the rocks. But I like to have my flies unweighted, just a personal thing.
Okay.
Personally, just so Jeff knows, I'm a huge advocate on swinging your flies all the way into shore and then waiting for a second and then giving a few strips before proceeding to cast again. And
okay.
I have more confidence that I'm able to truly swing all the way into shore by having an unweighted fly.
Okay. Geraldo asks, when the river flow is high but clear, is a sparsely dressed fly or a heavily dressed fly preferable, darker or brighter colors?
There's no rules for any of these things. Let me just read this. When a river flow is high but clear, is a sparsely dressed fly or heavy dressed fly? Well, remember that if you heavily dress your fly, it's going to sit higher in the water column. So to answer that, it depends on which river you're on, what species. You know, are they these winter or summer fish? Who went there before you? Again, all the same old questions. As far as darker or brighter colors, that, personally, when the river flow is high and clear, I fish darker. On a dean, I fish brighter. So it just, again, it depends on where you're at and the amount of confidence. How long have these fish been in the system for? How long have they been sitting in the live for? What have they seen throughout the day? Is there bait a lot on that river? Has somebody been fishing bait in front of this fish all day? Because when that's the case, I put on a green fly. I put something different on. I fish a lot of white, too.
Well, you know, you keep mentioning confidence, but a lot of people that might fish the dean might fish once in their life. It might be that, you know, that bucket list location. So what should one even try to prepare by tying flies before they come up there, or should you just buy them from the guides, or you know?
No, don't buy them from the guides. Sorry. I would love to take a whole bunch of fly orders right now. I would. But, no. One of the best parts is that, you know, you need to deserve these fish. I'm still working on being able to deserve these fish. I'm brand new to this whole fishery. You know, it's only been 3 years now. And part of the way to be able to fall in love with them is to devote an hour a night, at least, you know, behind your vise if you can. And, I mean, this is basically your offering for them. So take the time. You owe it to them to tie them something nice. And you mix a whole bunch of different colors. You know, you can do, let's say that you do 10 black, 10 pink, 10 orange, 10 white. But it just gives you that moment where you kind of have that connection. It's your own space in your own head. You're envisioning the fish taking. It just really gets you right into the zone.
Okay, we asked Mike from Maple, Ontario, asked about do you use articulated patterns, such as sculpins? Or other articulated ones, I guess.
Is that the question?
Yeah, do you use articulated
flies? Do I fish articulated patterns?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Okay. Lots and he also asked...
articulated patterns.
Pardon me?
Lots of them. And then the other thing to remember is that we are a single barbless hook fishery, so some people that tie articulated hooks or flies come in with double hooks. Just make sure that you clip the rear one.
Okay. Okay, so when you talked about a stinger. So when we talked about a stinger, I asked you, you know, do you use stingers? And you said yes. So your stinger is your primary hook, and you really don't have a hook on the front end. Is that the case?
That's correct.
Okay. Because, in other parts of the world, they have both those hooks. They're just, you know, insurance, I guess.
Yeah, I just got back from, actually, Michigan and Ohio. I was doing a circuit there, and the guys showed me their hooks, and I kept getting my fingers caught on them because I'm not used to having double hooks on there. So we just fished one single barbless hook.
Okay. Mike also said, he says, have you ever tied commercially? I ask because you have tied some beautiful patterns in the pages of Fly Fusion magazine.
Oh, thanks, Mike. I always love it when people are nice. Thank you, Mike. I appreciate that. I haven't tied commercially. I used to tie for a fly gal. I would offer custom ties, but to be totally honest with you, I got too busy. I'm a perfectionist, and I would take up to an hour per fly, and I just don't have the time anymore.
You wouldn't make much money, would you?
No, but it sure felt good.
Okay, let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk about presentation and strategies along those lines. So hang tight with me here, April. We're almost done.
Sure, yeah.
Women's Fly Fishing Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's Fly Fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group-guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome, and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net. That's www.womensflyfishing.net. Or call Pudge directly at 907-274-7113. It's 907-274-7113. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with April Vokey about steelhead from the Dean River. If you'd like to ask April a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. Receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, let me just look at a few questions we have here on the Internet, April. Let's see what we've got here. One question, Jim in Westcliff, Colorado. How long does a two-handed rod need to be effective? You mentioned you do seven.
Well, you can use your single-hand rod as a double-hand rod and have it be effective. But on Dean, or for most of the fisheries in BC, I'd say the most common rods are between 13 to 15 feet. I personally fish a 13.5-foot rod.
Okay. And that would be a 7, 8, or 9, as you said before, right?
I fish an 8. I'd say a 7, 8. 7, 8, somewhere in between 12.5 to 14.5 would work. Whatever you can find on a good deal.
Okay. Let's see. One question here about Larry Hull in Indian River, Michigan wanted to know how you got interested in fly fishing. How did you learn your skills, and why did you decide to get into guiding?
Oh, that's a lot of questions in one.
and you have to answer in 100 words or less.
Right. Fly fishing was a natural progression for me because I was a conventional angler. I was crazy about fishing at a really early age. Actually, I was crazy about the water at a really early age. So when I was a toddler, even, I loved the rain more than the water, which was very strange. More than the sun, I'm sorry, which was a little different. You know, I did enjoy the rain, and then we drive over creeks, and I couldn't help but stare, and my parents noticed that, and so they would, we'd park as we'd go over these creeks. We'd park, and my parents would walk down to the stream with me, and we'd look through the water, and I would always look for anything moving, and we'd turn over rocks and just take our time down by the stream bed. And then my dad doesn't really fish, but when I was, you know, a kid, we'd troll a worm around and just see what we could find. And then when I got my driver's license, when I was 16, I started going fishing every day. I had straight A's, so nobody could say anything about me skipping school. So I would take my 83 Buick Skylark, and I'd go down to the river, and the guys at the tackle shop thought I was crazy, and my friends thought I was completely crazy. And I'd take my old spinning rod, and I'd go fishing for whatever was in the river. And then one year I timed it right for salmon, and started to really get into salmon fishing, and busted up my spinning rod real fast, and upgraded to a bait caster, which eventually turned into a center pin, and then eventually I got bored. I caught so many fish, I just got bored. So the natural progression was to start fly fishing, and I had seen some men on the river doing it and was fascinated by it. And I, at this point, had established a small crew of fishing buddies. They were all a bunch of guys in their late 60s, and they had adopted me on the river because they had kept seeing me out there alone, and I guess, like my parents, they thought it was slightly dangerous, so we started to fish together, and they knew that I really wanted more than anything to learn how to fly fish. And for my birthday, I think it was my 18th birthday, we all had my get-together, and they gave me my gift, which was an old Shakespeare rod, which was my first fly rod. and they threw in this box a pile of old chenilles and a bunch of jigging material and an old vise that Dave, one of the guys, had laying around. And that was a birthday gift, and so I decided that I was going to take all this gear and I was going to do it right. So I got a bunch of VHS tapes and started practicing and decided that it was going to be something I was going to master, and my parents were very frustrated because they told me I should be doing something more productive, and I would tell them that I was doing something productive. I was educating myself because nobody would take me seriously if I didn't know what I was doing. And I had established that I wanted to somehow make a living out of fly fishing because it's the only thing I wanted to do. I didn't want to do anything else. And my parents taught me that, you know, if you want to be happy in life, you need to follow your dreams and follow your heart. So I sought out, you know, I set out to be good at what I do. And after that, I started guiding for another operation when I was 21 and didn't agree with the way that they ran their business. I felt it was impersonal and like it was very much get them in, get them out. My guests were thrown at my boat in the morning. They got into my boat. You know, they were told to snag and to fish by the guy that owned the company, and it just wasn't for me. And so shortly after that, I left, and I should make note that I was also a sturgeon guide, and that just quite worked for me. So I started Fly Gal when I was 23 and decided that I was going to give it my all and continue to set out to being the best angler that I could be because I knew that people needed to trust me as an angler to come out with me. And over the years, I have made a lot of mistakes, learned a lot of lessons, and made a lot of achievements. So here I am today, 29, and still rocking.
Well, you're almost ready to level off on your age at 30, right? So
yeah, I know. Well, I'm starting to freak out. I turned 29 in 3 weeks. So.
Wow. All right.
Ooh,
well,
30,
he'll live through it all. He'll live through it all. My daughter just turned 30 this year too. So when she's still alive.
That makes me feel better then, because I'm going, oh my God, I need to get married. I need to have children. And all I want to do is go fishing. This is horrible.
Well, great. Great story, and that fills people in on who you are and how you came to be, so it's great. Duke in New York want to know about what do you think essential skills to become a successful steelheader are? And he also follows that up as a guide, what are the most common mistakes people make when steelheading?
Well, there's a few, so bear with me here. Casters versus fishers. If you can find somebody who is a caster and a fisher in one, they're brilliant to fish with. But the people who just want to spend all day casting and they don't want to take the time to be strategic on where their fly lands and what it is done with it after it's in the water, those are the people that don't catch as many fish. So my first bit of advice would be to slow down. Just take the time to slow down and analyze it all. You know, it's I tell people this, it's like puzzle pieces. You need to figure out which puzzle pieces work best together. So when you get to a run, it's not as simple as cast, bend, swing, strip, step. If it were that simple, you'd be bored to tears. And some people live their angling lives like that, but there's more to it. So I would advise that you get to the river, don't drop out to your waist, start in close at your ankles, and swing in close to shore. So slow down and just really figure out where the fish would be. Where would you be if you were a fish? After you slow down, you're not standing out too far, make sure that you are letting your fly swing all the way in close to shore. That's probably the number one mistake that I see, is that people don't allow their fly to swing all the way into the dangle before they begin to strip in and cast again. And so they end up missing a ton of fish, and it's painful for us to watch. So just take the time to let your fly hit the true dangle, go ahead, give it a couple strips, and then proceed to cast again. So that's the most common mistake I see.
Okay. And as far as your presentation goes, for most steelhead fishing, do you want to describe how you present your fly?
Every situation is different. If I get to a long sweeping run and it's a summer run fish, I'm going to want to do more of the traditional cast on a slightly downstream angle and let my fly swing all the way close to shore and hope that something takes mid-swing. But if I get to the head of a run, because I did fish conventional gear for so long, I like to fish it right. You know, I like to dump line off my reel, get my fly into that trough. I do a bunch of high sticking. I do a lot of walking the fly out, maintaining it through the current. I fish behind a lot of rocks, a lot of pocket water fishing. It really, really just depends. With winter steelhead, oftentimes I like to cast slightly upstream. Is there a riffle in between me and the seam on the other side? It's so situational, it's too hard to answer in one bout.
Okay. So, and again, I think we have, let's see here. Oh, we got a question here somewhere.
I think you should ask a question about what I soak my glow bugs in.
Oh, I skipped over that one. You want to go back to that one? Yeah. Somebody had asked. Yes, about what's your favorite glow bug pattern and what scents do you dip them in?
I think he's kidding.
Probably. Just tell him Chanel number 5.
I was
going to
tell him that I dip them in wild steelhead skein. No, I don't fish glow bugs. Although, for winter steelhead, I've started to fish the occasional glow bug or bead underneath my indicator with some clients, and I don't know, my favorite one is one that doesn't crack off when it hits the rocks behind them. That's cute, though, Jeremy. Thank you. I appreciate that one. It made me laugh.
Martin Coleman asked, does it really take 1,000 casts to catch one steel? And if it does, why do you do it?
That's a great question. No, it does not take 1,000 casts, but it could. So it just takes one lucky angler or someone who understands fish behavior. So I don't know why they say it's 1,000 casts, because for summer run steelhead, that's certainly not the case. For winter run steelhead, it might be. But those are very special anglers that do that sort of fishing. They're anglers. I've actually written a piece about it, and I'll say it again. I'm proud to call those anglers my friends, because they really get the sport. Why do we do it? Because we absolutely love it. And when it's so much more than just the fish, there's so much that encompasses steelheading. You know, it's not even camaraderie, because I'd be lying to you if I told you I like to fish with people. Personally, I try to get away from people when I fish. But it's the smells, the everything else that you need to take in and appreciate to really enjoy your day on the water. With steelheading, and when you're not getting that many, you have time to really enjoy all of that and take it all in. I really can't give you any other answer. I would tell you that we're crazy, but then I'd be coming back to Pete's initial question, and I don't want to go back on me saying that I'm not crazy.
I think
we love it.
Yeah, and that, you know, I think there are certain fish that we consider trophy fish, you know, tarpon, permit.
Yeah, tarpon, permit are driving me broke. Martin, if you're listening to this, permit are driving me broke. I sold my house. I have scheduled myself on more saltwater trips than I know what to do with, and I cannot for the life of me land a permit. And why do I do it? Because it's this, I love it. I mean, it's like when you have something in your mind that you are set out that you're going to catch, there's this romance that evolves in your head, and you just, you live every moment, and you're constantly, your shoulders are tensed, and you're just waiting for that one moment. And then more importantly, when it does happen, the feeling of satisfaction that comes over you, the way that you feel when you lay down at night and your head hits the pillow, that feeling is indescribable. And there's nothing else that can be equivalent. I don't have children, so I don't know. But in my world, nothing else is equivalent to that feeling. And that's why I'd be willing to make 2,000 or 3,000 casts just to catch that one fish. No. And when am I coming back to the White River again? Hopefully sooner than later.
Okay.
Reading that second part of his question.
Yeah. We did have, it said, Jeff in Chilliwack again. Jeff wrote in a lot of questions. Thanks, Jeff. How do I prevent steelhead from getting off the hook? I'm using the best stinger hooks out there, owner number one. How do you set the hook? And you had mentioned this earlier. Yeah. It's one thing catching or hooking. It's another thing landing. So why don't you talk about that whole process and what tips you can give there?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I actually do a presentation on this, and I demonstrate with video different hook sets and how the fish get landed. You're using a stinger hook, so right away your ratio should have gone up. By having a stinger hook, you're able to interchange, as Jeff knows, but I'll just let the rest of the viewers know, by fishing a stinger hook, you're able to interchange your hooks out. So if your hook gets dollar bent out, you can just go ahead and change that hook out and put a new one on. Personally, I use Gamagatsu. I always have. I can honestly tell you that my landing ratio is quite high. Every angler has their strength, and while mine is not as a caster or, really as a caster, my strength is landing fish. So I do use the gammies. Owners are just as good, though. As far as setting the hook, just reading his question here. I hold a soft slip of line, so 6 to 8 inches of line. I pinch it underneath my index finger on my handle, and then when the fish takes, it basically pulls the soft loop of line out of my hand, so when I go to set the hook, it slaps down into that fish's mouth. It definitely gets a strong hook set, and I don't end up ripping the hook out of the fish's mouth. That's controversial. I know on the Deschutes they like to have a longer belly of line rather than 6 to 8 inches, but the soft loop technique definitely has seemed to work for myself and my circle of friends. Be warned that if you're giving your fish on the dangle, meaning that it's while your fly is basically parallel to shore, you don't have the luxury of having the current aid in getting that hook up in the fish's maxillary or in the mouth. So you're really setting it to the snout and the straight up hook set without any current. So you're more likely to lose those fish, and just don't get discouraged. And finally, the other thing is if you're fishing a skagit head, you need to remember that you have 26 some odd feet of that grain weight pouring down on you. So even though you have your rod tip high in the air, you'll see that there's still a small belly of line if you don't really pull hard. So if you're fishing a skagit line, you really want to make sure that you are completely straight to that fish, because oftentimes that extra grain weight will pull down and give that fish the slack it needs with single barbless hook.
Great tips. Duke in New York, we got a couple more questions and then we'll call it quits here. Duke in New York, he says, I'm a proud father of a 7-year-old daughter. I find your success in fly fishing industry very encouraging. I would like my daughter to try out fly fishing and chasing these mythical creatures. Do you have any word of wisdom to share with hopeless fathers like I am as to what are the best ways to help out your daughters to get them interested in fly fishing?
Oh, that's a great question, and thank you very much for the kind words, Duke. Words of wisdom. I meet a lot of fathers that have the same question, and it's funny because they basically come to me at the shows and they hand their daughters to me, and I say, okay, Dad, you need to just go away for a while now. And it's fun because I get to listen to the girls tell me that their daughter, that their father is so embarrassing. Oh, my gosh, he's so embarrassing. And I get to listen to what they have to say, and then it's my responsibility to let them know that their dad's really cool, because you see how far he can cast? I mean, I wish my dad could cast that far. So I think that a huge part of it is having somebody else come into their lives as well that can let them know that it is really cool, or hire a guide for the day so that they can see that their dad really does know a whole lot with the guides, you know, because the guides and dads can often play off each other. Keep it simple. Don't take her out for too long. That's definitely a major turning point. As soon as they feel like they've been out for too long, they start to resent it. But most importantly, make it their thing. So same with girlfriends, same with wives. As soon as it's your thing and I do it because my dad or because my boyfriend or my husband does it, it just takes away from it entirely. So you want her to feel like it's hers. So get her own rod. You know, get her a T-shirt. Doesn't need to be pink. God knows the whole pink thing is just over with. But, you know, get her something that's hers and let her call the shots. And it's always really nice when she can teach you something. So don't be shy to give her to somebody else for an hour. Go to the trade shows and hand her off to a younger role model or a different role model to show her some stuff, for some casting tricks, and then have her come back to you and let her show you what she learned and learn from her. And that way you guys are sharing the experience together, and it makes a huge difference.
Yeah, yeah. And just to piggyback on that, we did an interview, which is in our archives, with Fanny Krieger, and Fanny did a great video on teaching children how to fly fish, and talked about a lot of things you just talked about as well, plus some other things. So I'd encourage Duke to listen in on that, maybe get Fanny's DVD, and something that he and his daughter can watch together and learn from. So.
Yeah.
Great.
Absolutely.
Well,
absolutely. Definitely get that.
Yeah. So, April, we've run out of time, and but we do have a few things to take care of here yet. We've got to give away our prizes, a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, and a one-year subscription to Hook Now. Easy. So stick with us here a few more minutes. We'll give these things away, and then we'll call it a night.
Sounds good.
The Sacred Headwaters is a vast alpine basin in northern British Columbia, where three of Canada's greatest wild salmon rivers, the Skeena, Nass, and Stikine, all begin with their journeys to the Pacific Ocean. Here, adjacent to the renowned Spetitsi Wilderness, hard for me to pronounce some of these words, Wilderness Grizzly
Let me know
bears,
if you need a hand.
Yeah. Spatsi? How do you pronounce it?
Spatsisi?
Spatsisi Wilderness, grizzly bears, stone sheep, and Osborne caribou exist in large numbers, and wild trout return each year to spawn. There's currently a two-year moratorium on coal bed methane development in the Sacred Headwaters imposed by the BC government. We have less than 1 year remaining. Royal Dutch Shell's subsidiary, Shell Canada, have not changed their intent for a fully industrialized coal bed methane project in the Sacred Headwaters. Sacred Headwaters is also rich in mineral and energy resources, including coal and coal bed methane gas trapped in coal deposits. Royal Dutch Shell, through its subsidiary Shell Canada Energy, wants to turn the Sacred Headwaters into a coal bed methane gas field. If this plan goes ahead, the rich alpine ecosystem will be converted into an industrial landscape with thousands of gas wells connected to a maze of pipelines and roads. If you'd like to find out more about this and learn how you can get involved, visit www.skeenawatershed.com. It's S-K-E-E-N-A watershed.com. And go there to find out how you can help get involved. Just a quick reminder, everyone. Sure. Before you leave website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section on tonight's show that says, "What did you think of this show?" Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. But it's now time to give away a few prizes. The first two come from our registration database and are randomly selected from that database. If you didn't register yet, it's too late now, but make sure you do on our next show, and maybe you'll win one of these prizes. The first prize we're going to give away is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. To learn more about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org, and a great organization to support and be part of, and it's an international organization as well. Walt Cole is our winner there from California, Walt Cole. So congratulations, Walt, and if you already have a membership, we'll get you extended. So we'll contact you after the show by email so that we can get your information and get that membership started. And now let's give away that one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, and that's one that April contributes to as well, a great magazine out of Calgary, Canada, beautiful photography, and lots of great how-to articles. And to learn more about them, go to flyfusionmag.com, flyfusionmag.com. And our winner for that is Durand Mathy in Wisconsin. So congratulations, Durand. And I know you'll enjoy that subscription as well. Okay, now we're going to give away a one-year subscription to Hooked Now magazine. And if some of you haven't heard of this, it's an online e-zine published by Dave Hughes, Rick Kafley, and Skip Morris. three great fly fishermen that have been around a long time and have quite the reputation. So check it out. You can go to hookednow.com, and see what they're doing. And so now let's ask a question, and the first person answered correctly will win this 1 year subscription to Hooked Now. The way you do this is go to our homepage. There's a text box there. Fill in your answer, your name, and your location. First person to give us the correct answer will win the subscription. So, question is, there were two bright colors April suggested that you use on the lower dean for steelhead. What were those two colors for your flies, the two bright colors? And we'll see who gets this, April.
And drum roll, please.
Pardon?
I said drum roll, please.
Drum roll, please, yeah.
Drum roll.
Oh, they're slow tonight. They're slow tonight answering. Somebody's got to pop in here. And we've got an answer, pink and orange. Is that the answer I was looking for, April?
That's the answer. Wow, there's really actually people out there listening.
Yeah. Well, at least Dean Very Wormall cool. in Westford, Massachusetts was listening because
Hi, Dean.
He submitted that answer. So congratulations, Dean. And you just got yourself a 1 year subscription to Hooked Now Easy. So, Dean, send us, let's see, you just, you did send me your email. That's all I need from you, Dean, and I'll forward that on to the folks over there, and they'll get you started. So thank you very much and for playing, and we appreciate it. Okay. Well, that's about it, April. I want to thank you for being on the show tonight and sharing all your experiences, and your conservation efforts are appreciated by all, I'm sure. But thanks for taking your time out and share those experiences and your goals and watch down the road. So.
Thanks, Roger.
Our next broadcast will be on April 4th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, we're going to interview Jeff Blood, and our topic for the show will be designing and building a great fly rod. Jeff is a lifelong fly fisher, and he's going to talk to us about what it takes to design and build a commercial fly rod. He'll dispel the myths and sweep away the smoke and mirrors of advertising, get down to what it really takes to make a great fly rod. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Hooked Now Online E-Zine, Mystic Rods, Housatonic River Outfitters, Front Range Anglers, and Women's Fly Fishing Alaska for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673 extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673 extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.